Okay, so I'll get started here. I wanted to start by just acknowledging my co-authors who are graduate public health students at the Dartmouth Institute, where I also work, and we have no financial disclosures to make. A little bit of background: my presentation is about direct-to-consumer drug advertising and a process that's out there that's supposed to sort of promote a dialogue between consumers and advertisers. So a little bit of background to direct-to-consumer advertising. Basically, the pharmaceutical industry's claim for it is that it's an educational process, that it'll educate patients about new treatments and new or underdiagnosed conditions, and it'll sort of promote a dialogue between the patient and their doctor. Critics, including myself, claim some of the things that we claim is just that these advertisements promote the newest and most expensive drugs, but not necessarily the most effective drugs. They create increased demand regardless of whether it's actually there or not, including in some cases creating conditions that may or may not be real from a biomedical perspective. They're also coordinated with direct-to-doctor marketing, so that when the patient asks about a drug, obviously the doctor may have free samples and will be will understand that this message is out there. And sampling, or the ability of a doctor to give out free samples, has been correlated with increased prescription writing and increased prescription costs, but not necessarily better care. The spending on direct-to-consumer drug advertising is quite large. You can see it's estimated about $5.25 billion in 2007, and individual drug marketing campaigns are also quite large, in the hundreds of millions, as you can see there. Even though direct-to-consumer advertising is only legal in the United States and New Zealand, there are growing international consequences with the use of the internet, and we're actually doing some research looking into that hopefully for APH 2010. So the FDA in the United States requires basically that the ads are not supposed to be misleading. They should balance risks and benefits. You can't do off-label advertising through DTC. Unfortunately, there's relatively little oversight, and in cases where drugs manufacturers have sort of violated the FDA requirements, there's no major penalties. They just have to stop advertising, but in many cases, the advertisement has already run its course anyway. So PhRMA, which is the Pharmaceutical Researchers and Manufacturers Trade Group, in 2005, they created this Office of Accountability, which was supposed to set standards, industry standards, for advertising. They have a whole list of sort of standards. I'm not going to read through them all. Basically, the first point summarizes it, that they should educate consumers about the medicine and, where appropriate, the condition. And they give some more specifics, which I won't go through. Part of this system also involves an ability to receive comments and respond to comments from the public, sort of to create a dialogue that should be educational. And every year they publish a report talking about how many comments they get. As you can see, it's not a whole lot. They received about 1,200 comments in 2008. When you think about the volume of consumers that are being bombarded with messages, that's not a whole lot of people. Again, most of the comments were from patients and consumers, and many of them were requesting more information. Exact numbers are hard to get. Pharma's a little bit vague on that. So the purpose of our study was just to test the system to see what the response rate would be, what kind of information you would get back as a consumer, and whether it would be helpful or not. Basically, would it be educational? Would it help you as a consumer make a decision about a drug treatment? So we took a convenience sample of 27 drug advertisements for 23 different drugs and 14 from 14 manufacturers from various popular media, and we used the PhRMA established process for submitting our questions. Here's a list of the drugs. You'll probably recognize many of the names, and the venues that they are advertised in were sort of major things like U.S. News and World Report, National Geographic, Time Magazine, that kind of thing. Here's an example of one of the ads for Boniva. Obviously, this ad has run its course. They have the same pitch person, though. And this is the form that PhRMA has you fill out. You basically give them your name and address, what the drug name is, the manufacturer, describe the ad so they can, and then you give your comment at the bottom. And then you mail it into PhRMA. PhRMA then responds to you, and then mails your comments on to the manufacturer, who will then respond to you in kind. Here's a couple other examples. You're probably pretty familiar with these. You have sort of the colorful, attention-grabbing page, and then you have sort of the fine print, which people may or may not be able to make out. And here's a third example. So our findings, we heard back about half of the time, 53% of the time, in cases where multiple inquiries were sent, there were several Pfizer drugs, for example, and half of the time, respondents, the companies responded to all of our requests. The other half, they didn't respond, and then there were a couple cases where they responded sort of some of the time. Also, one of the reasons our response rate was kind of low, there are two companies who were not members of pharma and didn't take part in this process. In one case, pharma let us know that. In the other case, we didn't know that until we heard from the legal department of that company. In terms of how long it took them to get back to us, those companies that did respond to us, it took about 2 months, 77 days, and it ranged anywhere from 28 days to 122 days. In terms of the helpfulness, we found that there were sort of five general strategies that they would use when they would respond to us. One was sort of the thanks for your message, your letter. We appreciate these comments, and we'll basically think about it. Then there was sort of unsubstantiated statements of compliance. They would sort of restate what we had said to them and said that they in fact were in compliance with the code of conduct. Then they would also direct us to another site. Again, thanks for your comment. Go to our website. You can learn more. Sometimes they would state that the concern was not covered by the code of conduct. There are a few cases where we mentioned you're educating us about the drug, not about the condition, and you're not mentioning anything about how effective your condition is. And they'd say, well, the code of conduct doesn't say anything about relative efficacy, so we're covered. And then there was times when they would say, thanks for your comment, and please go talk to your doctor for more information. In five cases where they did send us more information, it was either a study citation or something like official label or a brochure. And by brochure, the type of thing that a doctor would get. So again, not real helpful if you're a consumer or you don't have access to the New England Journal of Medicine or the ability to interpret that kind of technical data. So basically, our conclusion is that the process was not very helpful for patients. The poor response rate, information when you did get it was slow, and it wasn't really helpful, and it wasn't anything that you couldn't get sort of in 15 minutes on the internet. The limitations, there were a relatively few number of queries. We sent in only 27. Of course, a consumer might only send in one or two. And also, we had some of our queries may have been viewed as a little bit challenging. We would sort of say, you're supposed to do this, and you didn't. So they may have, that may have, in some cases, triggered a legalistic response. We got some responses from the legal department, which weren't not helpful in terms of patient decision making.